I give the opportunity people to ask any more questions that you like. Actually, there was a question from lunchtime that, what do we do at the monastery anyway? What happens on a daily basis? So just give a general overview of what a day would be like at the monastery. I think also just to say that the monastery is actually open for people to come and visit, whether it's just popping in or people want to come and stay. You have to check in ahead of time, but see if there's space. Generally, the monastery is available for people to plug in. But a day begins sometime before 5 in the morning. We have 5 o'clock in the morning is morning chanting, morning meditation. Close out about 6:30, and then there's just some tidy up, clean up, and at 7 o'clock there's a light breakfast, tea, coffee, whatever anybody needs, wants. And it's very basic, very simple. And then and in the morning at 7:30 we gather together and distribute chores, work for the day. Some people will do trail work, some people will help with maintenance, some people help with office stuff, some people help with the kitchen. And then at 11 o'clock we gather for the main meal of the day. After the meal, there's just clean up, and then people disperse back to their dwelling places. And that the afternoon is open for people to study, to meditate as they wish. And then 5:30, there's an informal gathering for tea time, and usually there's somebody available, senior. Monk will be there to field any questions, if there are any, Q&A, and then I'd usually finish that up about 6:30, 7 o'clock, evening chanting, meditation, and it's usually over about, I don't know, 8:15 or so. And then people go back to their dwelling places. So it's a pretty simple routine, simple life.
I'd like to comment on my question earlier.
Uh-huh.
Climate change. And while you were answering, I got the answer, and that is the more we become more like monks, more like nuns, the more we're going to be helping the situation.
Yes, I mean, it's because a lot of it is around simplicity, contentment, sensitivity, generosity. Sharing, those are all the qualities that will allow us to survive as human beings. And not just survive, but actually enjoy it. Yeah?
Living as sustainably is one thing.
Yes, yes. It's just living sustainably, living lightly on the planet, on the land. Yes?
So on the lines of relationship, can you give some ideas or suggestions or comments on dealing with betrayal?
Uh-huh. This is a question around relationship and how to deal with betrayal. I think one is, there's many different aspects to it. One of the things that first popped into my mind is when the Buddha was asked a question of what are the highest blessings. He gave a series of about 38 different qualities that lead to the highest blessings. And the first quality was, don't associate with fools. And Bala is sort of fool, but it's also, you know, not a particularly good person. You want to, keep your distance from people who don't have the qualities of commitment, virtue. It was like when we were this morning talking about the qualities that the Buddha pointed to as who is a good friend, a good companion, sort of one who is consummate in in faith and confidence, but it's also faith and confidence in something that is really noble, and taking that nobility, somebody who is virtuous, who is generous, who is discerning. So those are our qualities we want to seek out in people. And if somebody doesn't measure up to that, then it's good to keep one's distance. It isn't a judgment in the sense of lifting oneself up and putting somebody else. One needs to associate with other people, and particularly in relationship, then you want to draw close to somebody who is actually nurturing a relationship, and that requires give and take on both sides, so that when somebody betrays trust, then there's a sense of on some occasions one might recognize, or they might recognize their unskillfulness, but it's up to them to make a change. It's not up to us to make excuses for people, and of course I'm a monk, so it's sort of it's easy for me to say. It's a lot easier to, if somebody isn't really worth drawing close to, then it's better to be on one's own and find that contentment. It's too painful to be with people who are who don't reciprocate trust. Yeah. That works in the monastery as well, even if we're sort of not in intimate relations. But if somebody is not really forthright and clear and skillful in their actions, they don't last long in a monastery. It's too difficult for everybody.
I wonder if you could say something more about how to practice being aware of arising and ceasing, and also in relationship to the question of, you said that wisdom, and then right view would normally follow, and wisdom is connected with arising and ceasing. Mm-hmm. So is there a distinction between wisdom and right view? Maybe that's also... Mm-hmm. Be addressed at the same time, that you say something more about the practice of arising and ceasing in different ways in meditation.
Yeah, with that quality of thank you. Arising and ceasing is a it's good to, because sometimes, especially as Buddhist teachers, we can get used to our jargon. What's it mean anyway? So it's important to clarify that, ask that. But the sense of paying attention to the the arising, falling away, coming into being, the ending of either material phenomena or mental phenomena, and as we practice, that, and I was emphasizing that because we tend to think that if only I had wisdom, then I'd be okay. And then wisdom then tends to be sort of assumed to be some kind of some particular bit of knowledge or some kind of particular way of seeing something. But it's more paying attention to processes. And the Buddha points out the importance of that process of coming into being, passing away. Now, one of the ways that it's usually called is just impermanence, just looking at the impermanence of phenomena. But the way that Ajahn Chah talks about it is the uncertainty. And sort of impermanence tends to objectify what one's experiencing as arising and ceasing. Uncertainty tends to be the subject, in the sense, how do I feel about it? How do I experience it? So to be able to be comfortable with that uncertainty. Because we tend to, want to have everything solid, secure, clear, absolutely pin it down, and then I'll be happy and secure. It's much more important and I think that's a doorway to wisdom, is learning how to be clear and comfortable with that, the changing nature of phenomena, how things come into being and pass away. One also starts to pay attention to these are causes and conditions that play out in certain ways. And it's not personal. It's not sort of we don't need to personalize it or create a sense of self and me around it. Just so these are conditions arising and ceasing, and there's a real ease and spaciousness that comes from that. And that kind of ease is, say, from discernment or wisdom, and being able to see clearly. So wisdom is just that applying the seeing clearly.
Seeing clearly without a sense of self, is that what you mean?
Ideally, but the reality is we overlay, and it's just that's part of the process of being watchful and attentive. What happens actually I pulled a quote out of a new book of Ajahn Chah's today, and I think it's a helpful and say, when discernment arises, or when wisdom arises, you can abandon your defilements. As your discernment grows, your behavior will change. You'll abandon your old ways. It's like going into the forest to look for fruit. At first you find some fruit that's not especially good, but even though it's sour, you take it. You carry it in your basket until you find fruits that are better than that. You throw the old fruits out of your basket. It's because you see that the new ones are better that you change what you're carrying. And the same with the mind. When you see the harm and drawbacks of your old ways, you keep on abandoning them. The more you look, the more you keep on abandoning. When you practice, you'll think, this is it, this is good. But when you practice further, oh, what happened then wasn't really refined. So you abandon that too. And so it's a lot of what wisdom is ability to, or what discernment is seeing clearly but then putting things down, relinquishing.
So is that related to arising and ceasing?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of, again, one doesn't invest overly invest in the kind of assumptions of goodness or perfection or even badness or wrong. In what, it's just something else that's arising and ceasing. And you learn from it.
Oh, that's the idea of putting aside or keeping. That's the learning.
Yeah, that's the learning.
Once you see it, you can learn from it.
You can learn from it, yeah.
So this applies not only to objects like the nature coming and going, but internal.
Internal, yeah, mind states. Absolutely. Applies across the board.
And so to be aware of that,
yeah,
is just patient with what's happening. So
patient, very good. Yes, there's a patience that's there. And that actually, I can remember so many times Ajahn Chah saying, I don't teach you guys much. Just be patient. And you think, I want to know more now. But then you start seeing, just being, and patience isn't just putting up with something, but willing to be present with it.
That's the difficulty of rising and ceasing, is that you don't want to be present with
exactly
something.
Exactly. Yes.
I really find myself curious about the role of emotion. We talk about passion, we talk about ceasing, and we talk about these more as either physical or mental experiences. But there's also, you talked earlier, I think, in the beginning about dropping into the heart, didn't you?
Yeah.
So what is your view of how that, I mean, all phenomena arise and cease, right?
Right.
Including emotion.
Yeah.
Things that we can share in a positive manner.
Mm-hmm.
What is your view of that?
Well, I mean, of course...
What is the question?
The question is around emotion in terms of... what's the role of, I guess, what's the role of emotion in our practice? And faith or confidence is an emotion. Happiness and well-being is an emotion. Kindness and generosity are emotions.
Compassion
is an emotion. So that these are, the Buddha is encouraging us to cultivate these wholesome, skillful emotions. And even when you think in terms of when the Buddha points to the Four Noble Truths as a structure, he says, be aware of suffering, cause of suffering, cessation of suffering, path leading to cessation of suffering. It's a lot of that is because we're motivated to try to do something about emotion, in that emotion of unsatisfactoriness or suffering. It could just as easily be structured, the happiness, cause of happiness, the cessation of happiness, path leading to happiness, or the arising of, so that but it's cast in a more of a, let's say, the via negativa, because we tend to be more motivated to pay attention to it, and we tend to be satisfied with the emotion of happiness or well-being. We tend to be content with that, whereas you have to be nuts to be content with suffering and dissatisfaction. So it keeps pushing us to seek more clearly, to relinquish, really understand.
I find that the experience of uncertainty and loss actually gives rise to the experience of compassion.
Oh, yeah.
To be empathetic, for example.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why it's so important to say when the Buddha structures his path, that right view is always first. And it's that right view that's leading so that it's taking us to a place of that skillful investigation or skillful holding of emotion. But it's all the different lists of the Buddha's teachings. When you look at it more clearly, you see how the Buddha is the positive role that emotion is playing in motivating and maintaining our momentum in practice. Yeah. Yeah.
So with the situation in Burma now,
mm-hmm.
with the fomenting of hatred and violence against the Muslims on the Buddhist monks, how do you determine whether to respond to that vocally or publicly? I think I've seen only one comment, and that's from the Dalai Lama. Have there been other comments from teachers in our tradition about
teachers
it?
And
is that appropriate, and how do you consider
responding? Well, I mean, certainly the response is not one of condoning, I think it's also a sense of dismay that is quite predominant. It's also Burma is such a closed country still that it's hard to imagine what sort of a response to formulate. In terms of how does one actually deal with it, and I don't know. Burma's a hard country to read, and I read a good article which I thought was interesting in that the projection or assumption of where this is coming from, coming back to the military as a, because there's things are changing quite quickly on a societal level, and it's being much more able to address the lack of a democratic process and to allow the popular voice of people to be heard. And the kind of overt and public role of the military is limited. The role of the military is incredibly entrenched, and it's another way, it seems to be, or it's a speculation on this particular writer's part, that it's another way that the military is able to implement keeping things stirred up so that the military will seem like a good option, a good fallback option. Which is, it's a dangerous game to play. And it's always, in human relations and politics, it's so often, it's that, let's demonize a minority. And it's worked for millennia. So it seems to be that could be coming from that. But I don't know enough to speak authoritatively. But when I read that, somebody, a monk, sent that to me, and that's worth thinking about, because it is. You see the stories, and it's sort of like blink. And it's just this doesn't compute. But then looking at it in that light, then you think, oh yeah, there's... I mean, because there's always monks or... I mean, I've been a monk long enough that I can... You know, I've seen all sorts. And there's always monks who are willing to you know, be a part of the power structure that protects power. Yeah.
I always appreciate your words about practice and your emphasis on stability, clarity, and today I also heard spaciousness. And I've been working a lot with concentration, which in many ways helps support that. I noticed today when you mentioned concentration, you said, oh, I'm a little tense when I sit here. Just think of concentration. So with that, I suppose there's probably some fine-tunement that you've worked with, or I don't know, if you could talk more about that. What, you know, what is that feeling, and how do you work with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in terms of the... it's helpful to always return to the, you know, what was the question? Okay, sorry. Question is around the one appreciation of some of the themes that I've been pointing to in terms of concentration or meditation, stability, clarity, spaciousness. But I also, when I was bringing up concentration as I was saying, well, there's kind of, you know, some kind of inherent kind of tension going on there. Where is my thinking coming from? And how have I worked with that? And what perspective do I have on it? And I think that's essentially. To me, my perspective, you know, when I think of concentration, I think of, oh, I've got to really put my mind on what I'm doing and concentrate. It tends to be a bit tense. And the word that the Buddha uses that's translated into concentration is samadhi. And samadhi has a... When it's translated into Thai... language, it's like the firm establishing of the mind. It's sort of like a phrase rather than trying to get one word. So, I like that. Firm establishing of the mind, that's a good thing. And the word, the root of the word, say, samadhi, is one of tranquility. So that there's an ease there. So that those things that foster the mind settling, becoming stable, becoming clear, that's really important. And I think one of the, like I talked earlier about the stock phrases that oftentimes come up through the discourses. There's a stock phrase that set of conditions in mental development that the Buddha sometimes, he starts in different places. Sometimes it's with faith as a condition, sometimes with suffering as a condition, sometimes with wise attention as a condition, sometimes virtue as a condition. But with these different starting points, with that as condition, there's the arising of well-being. And then with the arising of well-being, there's the joy comes to be. With the arising of joy, tranquility comes to be. With the arising of tranquility, happiness comes to be. With the arising of happiness, samadhi comes to be. Concentration or that stability of mind comes to be. And it's interesting that there's all these conditions of happiness, joy, well-being, tranquility. Those are the conditions for the arising of that meditative stability, And because usually what happens, the way my mind has worked before, and I'm sure that it's the same, sort of like, boy, when I get my concentration together, I'm going to be happy. So it's like, you know, it's going for that goal in order to feel something. But the reality is, what are those conditions that make us...
Could you go over them again?
Yeah, okay. The first is a quality of well-being. And that's a, in the scriptural language, it's pamoja, which is, you know, just kind of well-being, kind of delight. With that as the condition, and there's a rising of joy, of piti. And then with piti as the condition, with joy, and then there's a rising of tranquility, which is an ease of, the tranquility of mind, but it's an ease of body, pasati, which is, it's relaxed, it's, yeah, there's a kind of total relaxation. And then with that as the condition, then there's the arising of happiness, sukha. And so then with happiness as condition, there's the arising of samadhi or of concentration. And in some of the discourses, the Buddha actually stops and it points it out and says, the happy mind is easily concentrated. And it's really true. So we in our meditation, just finding the themes and the ways of approaching the meditation that are the happiness is not just kind of excitement of getting what one wants, but just there's an ease and deep appreciation, well-being that's there, and that's what we want to be paying attention to.
Is the well-being a lack of hindrances?
Yeah.
That's what allows you.
That's a part of it. Is when we can relinquish the hindrances, or at least, you know, soften their impact a bit. We can let things drop away that actually agitate the mind. It's just like getting irritated or being dull or just endlessly proliferating about something. Just set those aside for a bit. And that feels good. So that tuning into that and then nurturing that, allowing that to become more of a presence within the mind, and the mind starts to settle. And it's actually, and as that progression continues, or that the stop phase with say samadhi or concentration as a condition, then one. Knows and sees the true nature of things. And it says, yatha bhuta jnana dasana. So knowledge and vision of the way things truly are. And it's from that point that there's a quality of relinquishment and putting down. Because sometimes, again, we try to get concentrated, or we're trying to let go of things. And they're trying to push away. They're trying to draw, I got to drop this. I got to get rid of my defilements. And we tie ourselves in knots with that. We should be paying attention. What is it that actually makes us feel comfortable, feel at ease, feel clear, feel spacious? What is it that helps the mind to actually be settled? Yeah, Neil.
It seems like in reality, at least for me, in the practice, you kind of start with concentration.
Mm-hmm.
You sit down, you try to get concentrated so that you can get to the place of well-being. And then the next. So it just seems
there's
a missing piece there, in both senses.
Well, in terms of, say, from a traditional perspective, you know, traditional Buddhist perspective, and a traditional, say, from a traditional, within a Buddhist society, that's the function of generosity and precepts. It makes you feel good. It clears the mind. It clears the clutter of the... So that those aspects of traditional practices of generosity, of dana, of keeping precepts, It's not in a moralistic way. This is a very practical way of preparing the mind to experience well-being. And generally in the West, you know, we approach it from a more psychological and meditation-based, so that oftentimes that's the case. You know, we, you know, butt our heads up against the meditation wall and say, what are we missing? And then, oh, wow, right. Yeah, I could be doing this as well. Yeah. So, it doesn't really matter where you start on this path. It does go, it's a traffic circle. It connects, they connect to each other. But it is helpful to get a whole picture of the whole path and realize how integrated and mutually nourishing those path factors are. Okay, one more question.
When we say each rightful path, is there any general rule to tell what is right, what is wrong?
Yeah. Generally, there's a real easy rule of thumb. If something is right in terms of in accord with Dhamma or in accord with the Buddha's teachings, then a wholesome mental states will increase and unwholesome mental states will decrease. And if you find that unwholesome mental states, unwholesome being things, greed, aversion, confusion, delusion, if that increases and sort of good qualities decrease, then you say, okay, that's not right. It's a natural thing, again, where one is paying attention to the results, as opposed to right in terms of what's right in my head. I thought it was right.
You have a metaphor like a traffic light thing turning up, you know, for right view. Can you elaborate that a bit? You mentioned
traffic circle.
Yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to just a straight line or a straight path, so that because the nature of a traffic, you can keep going around it and around, and it feeds back into itself. And because sometimes we think, if you know, we really want to start the journey here and we want to end up over there, and it becomes too linear, but it needs to actually work everything needs to work together. Okay?
Nurture.
Needs to support each other. Okay, let's take the last half an hour and just sit quietly, watch our breath, nurture our wholesome qualities.